Today, April 7th, is a cathartic day here in Israel. It's no less significant than yesterday, or tomorrow, or next week, but today does represent the milestone of exactly 6 months since the inhuman Hamas assault and massacre that ended with more than 1,200 murdered in Israel, many in the most brutal and horrific ways. Thousands injured, more than 250 taken hostage, of whom 133 are still in captivity by the terrorists in Gaza today. As of this morning, 260 soldiers have been killed in battle since the ground operation began. Thousands more are injured, and scores of widows and hundreds of new orphans. Since October 7th, Israel is a nation in grief, mourning, and still very much in shock and disbelief from what happened, all while living on the edge of the awareness that things may yet get very much worse before they get better. And despite this, we are a nation largely experiencing unity that's been unprecedented, albeit beginning to fray at the edges. Today, marking 6 months since October 7th, we're going to have a broad conversation on a wide range of topics, unpacking and framing what's happened in the past 6 months and looking ahead to the coming weeks, months, and even years. We're going to discuss military and intelligence issues, politics and diplomacy, the social and economic impact, where we are, and what needs to be done to defeat Hamas and free all the hostages, and the threats from other fronts, including Lebanon, Syria, and Iran. We have received many questions in advance, and we'll do our best to weave these into the conversation and invite those following the webinar to use the Q&A feature for questions that come up during the course of the conversation. We have an incredible panel, and I'm really grateful, and I'm pleased to introduce each of them bringing unique perspectives to the conversation. Major Elliot Chodoff is a political and military analyst specializing in the Middle East, the global war on terror, and the intersection of these. He's a decorated officer, a respected speaker, a frequently published commentator in a wide range of major news sites and journals. He has served in the IDF for 35 years and has been on active duty in the 2006 Lebanon War, in Gush Katif, during the 2005 Gaza disengagement. He is now completing his PhD in international relations at Bar-Ilan University. Rolene Marks is a highly regarded journalist appearing on numerous international radio and television programs and whose writing has been published in numerous global publications. She's the owner of Rolene Marks Consulting, specializing in media, public relations, and consulting on Jewish and Israeli-related issues, as well as media training. She's a PhD candidate as well in political anti-Semitism at the University of Middlesex in London. Chris Mitchell is the one who established the CBN, Christian Broadcast Network, news bureau here in Jerusalem in 2000. He's been covering major events in the region since then, including the Second Intifada, the Second Lebanon War, the Arab Spring, the rise of ISIS, the Abraham Accords, and told the story of the persecuted Christians from the Middle East. He's executive director of Jerusalem Dateline, tremendous biweekly program covering Israel and the Middle East that's seen all around the world. And he's the author of Dateline Jerusalem, an eyewitness account of prophecies unfolding in the Middle East. Elliot, Rolene, and Chris, you've all joined us before. I'm super grateful and thrilled to welcome you back. And I thank you each for taking the time to be with us today.
Thank you.
Pleasure.
Yeah. So let's jump right in. And I told you each individually, and so people who are following, I want to be sure that this is not me simply asking questions and waiting for your intelligent answers, but also interaction among the two. And I will do my best to moderate that as well. Let's start with at the beginning, if we will, 6 months ago. There were many mistakes that enabled the October 7th massacre to happen, and there will be many military and civilian inquiries in the months and perhaps years ahead. Without unpacking all of the issues, I'd love to hear from each of you, what's the one thing that you think was the biggest mistake and from which Israel has already learned and improved perhaps? Rolene, ladies first.
Thank you. First of all, I am very honored to share time with our esteemed panelists whose work I follow closely. So it's a huge honor for me. I think watching as the day unfolded with great horror and deep shock, I think for me personally, it was the response time or lack of response from our security forces. And I know that there are a lot of circumstances, and we're going to find those out as investigations unfolded. But it was a real concern watching our fellow citizens wondering why nobody was coming to help them in our darkest hour.
Okay, thank you. Elliot, we see you. I'm still going to give Chris the opportunity. Hopefully Chris will be joining us visually. But what do you think? What was the biggest, as they say here, fashla?
Well, I agree with what Raleen said, but I think that that's more the symptom than the disease, if you will. In other words, the long response time, even the initial success of the attack itself are reflections of a much deeper issue in the IDF. And here, I'm not talking about the intelligence failure. Jonathan, I think we've discussed this before. As bad as the intelligence failure was, the IDF should have been able to handle that even as a surprise. So the failure goes back to operational doctrine, preparation of ground forces, of air forces, of coordination that go back a decade of misconception, underestimation of the enemy, overestimation of high technology, abandonment of the basics of ground doctrine, of infantry warfare. Full disclosure, I'm an infantry officer. I've written infantry doctrine. And basically, by October 7th, a military that was totally unprepared to face the kind of attack that it should have handled, I don't want to say with ease, because no attack is handled with ease, but handily, if you will, with a division in the line. And that division was overwhelmed by 3,000 terrorists, and that just shouldn't have happened.
Have we learned from that? Are we prepared now?
We certainly learned from it on the level of, oops, that was bad. A good deal of the success that we've seen, I think, over the past 6 months also has to do with an incorporation of reservists with much deeper experience than the regulars who are on the ground. But the regulars have gained 6 months of experience. So I would say that the IDF today is a far better prepared military than it was 6 months ago, in part just because of 6 months of combat experience. But there are still many, many flaws that I see that will be costly, have been costly along the way, but nowhere near on the scale of what we saw 6 months ago.
Sure. Okay, Chris, until we get to see you, hopefully we can hear you. What are your thoughts? What was the biggest mistake and that Israel's already learned and improved from? You've been reporting on this a lot.
Yeah, first of all, I'm sorry for the technical issues and I haven't been able to log in. And as Raleen said, I'm honored to be with Raleen, Ellie, and yourself, Jonathan. The way I would answer that question is I would agree with Elliot. I think there was an underestimating the enemy and actually believing what they say they were going to do. They said it quite openly. In fact, personally, we've reported on this, and we reviewed a story that I believe we did in 2019 on the Gaza envelope in one of the kibbutz team. I said in my stand-up almost verbatim what they said they were going to do, that they were going to come in and attack and kill. And I think I even myself was a bit lulled into the fact that maybe they really couldn't do it, even what they said they could. I think the Iron Dome has a factor here too, because I think there was a sense of, well, the rockets come and the Iron Dome will take care of it, may hit a few people or a few buildings. I think, at least I felt that, as a sense of security, but not realizing the horror that was being built in the Gaza Strip for the last 17 years to allow us to go over in 2007.
Right, good point. Rolene, you're nodding in active affirmation.
I think two things, the apropos the Iron Dome. One thing we don't speak about enough, we actually speak about it all, was that on that Saturday, there were still rockets that got through the Iron Dome and caused substantial damage in cities, injuring people, and I think civilians were even killed because of the sheer overwhelming numbers of rockets fired from the Gaza Strip. I mean, thank goodness we do have these Iron Domes. But as Chris just said, and I think so accurately, there was maybe a false sense of security that don't worry, we've got the Iron Domes. And I think also a sense of hubris on our side that, you know, we're the most sophisticated army in the world. Our intelligence is superior. You know, don't worry, your little head. And believing the intelligence and underestimating the enemy that we are dealing with. This is an enemy that has spent 17 years preparing the battlefield very, very carefully, not just from a kinetic perspective, but also from a cyber social media and public relations perspective. And I think they didn't just catch Israel with our proverbial pants down, but the world as well, because I think while we, not just Israel, but the world has been focusing on a lot of non-issue issues, they have been studying very, very carefully our culture, our reactions to things, very carefully preparing infiltrations, not just in Israel, but around the world. And I think that one thing we have to realize is our battlefield is not just here in Israel, but it's also global. And we have realized it. The world now needs to realize it.
Ah, so the operative words being the world now needs to realize it, which suggests that you don't think the world does or perhaps doesn't care.
No.
Okay. Elliot, also no. We see the two of you shaking your head. Chris, are you also shaking your head? No.
Yes, I am.
Yeah. Okay. Jonathan, if I can jump in.
The Iron Dome, I do believe, gave Israelis a false sense of security, but I would say we reported on this since the beginning. It's a technological miracle, you know, the equivalent of a bullet hitting a bullet. I've seen it in action. I'm sure everybody's probably seen it in action. It's a marvel, and yet Israel was expected to do what hardly any other nation in the world would do. You know, we thought of scenarios. What if Mexico would shoot 10, 20, 100 rockets into Texas, or, you know, from Canada into Buffalo? Israel was expected to withstand this, and yet hardly any other nation on earth would have tolerated what Israel had for since 2007 and actually before that.
Correct. Elliot, you wanted to comment?
Yeah, there are two elements here. First, let me start with, I agree with both Chris and Rulene. I just want to expand a bit. About 5 years ago, I published an article roughly titled Iron Dome, a Critical Tactic and a Failed Strategy. Mm. In other words, and just quick summary, yes, anything you can do to protect your civilians and your citizens is a good tactic. But the failed strategy is that it makes the intolerable tolerable. And that has an impact on your mindset. It means, well, you know, a few rockets, we take them out, and you allow your enemy, A, to take the initiative to dictate when they're going to start, when they're going to stop. And it puts you in a situation of saying, you know what, I can take this. I don't have to worry about it. Three can become five, and five can become eight. And that's before you get to the failure. And Chris, you're absolutely correct. On that morning, the Iron Dome was overwhelmed in some cases. And here, you know, just to jump ahead, when it happens with Hezbollah, I know we're not there yet in the discussion, the Iron Dome is going to be essentially useless. But hold that thought for a moment. The second element to this is an error that we've always made, we continue to make, and that is the belief that just because we're right, the world will understand it. Yeah. And we tolerated the rockets, and we set the bar for the world to say, you know, we can tolerate this. It's okay for them to fire rockets at us. Then October 7th happened, And we were just so confident that after October 7th, after the horrific savage attack, well, the world would get it. And guess what? The world doesn't get it. The half-life memory of dead Jews is very, very short in the world. And we've played it, so to speak, over the past 6 months as if it was going to last forever. Well, it didn't. It barely lasted a month or two, and in some cases, not even a week.
Correct.
So that's apropos the global battlefield that we've essentially left to our enemies from the outset.
Thank you, Elliot. As we're having this conversation, I realized not only could we could go on in many, many different directions, but we could go on all night on any one of these topics. So apologies in advance to everybody who wants more information and to dig down, but I want to try and give a wider view there, partly because the impact has been wide, but also partly because the interest is wide. So I'd like to move it along a little bit. Right away, the Prime Minister on October 7th came on TV and said, we're at war. And if not immediately, literally then, very shortly thereafter, two main goals were, and we didn't even know how many hostages there were, was the two goals of the war were to eradicate Hamas from Gaza and to bring back all of the hostages, to release all of the hostages. Let's first talk just on the military side, as far as the campaign. Today, timely or not, I don't know, it was announced that the IDF is pulling back in southern Gaza. So I want to ask each of the three of you, what are your thoughts on where we stand vis-a-vis eradicating of Hamas in light of today's news or before it? And has it even been successful, and can it be, to eradicate Hamas? Is that even 6 months later a legitimate, realistic goal? Elliot, go ahead.
Yes, first of all, it's a realistic goal. The naysayers who say that you can't eliminate an ideology are correct. We're not trying to destroy an ideology. We're trying to destroy an organization. And the parallel that I would use is Nazi Germany, which was destroyed in May 1945. Nazism was not destroyed. We still see it out there today. But Nazi Germany ceased to exist and has never come back. So it is doable. Whether we'll succeed or not remains an open question. But is it an achievable goal? The answer is yes.
Okay, good. Thank you, Chris. I heard you had an audible sound there. What do you want to comment on?
No, I agree. You can't defeat an organization like Hamas or ISIS. ISIS still does exist here in the Middle East, but as a threat to the whole region, it had been dismantled. And the Nazi Germany analogy is very apropos, knowing that my dad fought in Italy against Nazi Germany. So. Yeah, right now it seems, and I'm sure Elliot can address this, it feels like we're stuck and stalled. Maybe that's a better word. And I know you'll get into this as well, Jonathan, but it looks like the United States has a great deal to do with the fact that the IDF is stalled. And I think one, I'll add this, we were in the, we were inside Khan Yunis, went to go into one of the tunnels there, and General Goldfuss, who I believe and commands the 98th Division, the ubiquitous nature of these tunnels and these weapons, I think, surprised even the IDF. It's just the battle in the last 6 months has been unprecedented, what kind of battle they've faced and the amount of tunnels and weapons inside Gaza.
Elliot, you want to add something to that before I ask Rolene?
Just a couple of quick sentences and concluding with what happened today. The IDF has been incredibly successful. The victory on the ground has been unprecedented. Urban warfare on this scale, with the every casualty is a tragedy, but with the low level of casualties that we've had, the eradication of all but five or six, depending on how you count them, Hamas battalions out of 26, 28, has been incredible. Now, we've taken all of Gaza, but Rafiah and El Borej and Nuseirat to smaller areas in the central southern part of the strip. Sitting in Gaza City and Khan Yunis with large forces would be a mistake. We have moved to the guerrilla stage of the war. We've passed the initial military stage, in other words, the military opposition stage. We destroy the battalions. We destroy the brigades. Being there now provides them with targets with no particular advantage. The Shifa-style operation of the last couple of weeks is going to become the model now of northern Gaza and Khan Yunis. Rafiah is next. Rafiah has not been hit yet. It's still in the, we're in that pre-phase. The division that was pulled out today, the 98th, is likely, and here I'm not giving away any military secrets because I'm not part of the planning on that level. Been there, done that. I know Khan Yunis very well back from the old days, and Rafiah and the other places. The way into Rafiah is not through Khan Yunis, it's through the area of Kerem Shalom. So pulling out of
Kerem Shalom, which is the Israeli border to the Negev.
Exactly, on the Negev side, where if anybody who can see a map, driving toward the sea where the left flank of the Israeli drive would be the Egyptian border into Rafiah. That would be the staging area. It's the only way to do it. Again, there aren't a lot of options here. Pulling that division out, in addition to getting it out of the out of Khan Yunis and simply being a target, and giving those guys a week to recuperate, to get their equipment back up to scale, to do a little bit more prep and training, makes perfect sense. It does not contradict the idea of going into Rafiah in a week or in 10 days. Now, I'm not saying that's what's going to happen. I'm simply saying that what happened today does not contradict that as a possibility.
Interesting. That's very insightful, because all the commentary I've heard is that we're rolling over, and Chris, you alluded to it as well, to pressure from the U.S., but Elliot's saying this is actually solid military strategy.
I think the pressure from the U.S. has had an effect, but I don't think it's the cause.
As remarkable and miraculous as Israel is, and its very existence a testimony to God's faithfulness, in many ways, Israel's like most other countries. Just as there are parents anywhere who have stronger and weaker parenting abilities, and adults become a product of situations in their lives that they cannot control, making their ability to raise and care for their own children even harder, that's true in Israel as well. The Genesis 123 Foundation is committed and takes the mandate seriously to care for the least of these, our brothers, our children. We're committed to bless and strengthen orphans and at-risk youth, to invest in them, to empower them, so that their future will be brighter than their past or their present. But Israel is unique in that there are always threats of war and terror which know no bounds. For children who come from homes that are not safe, sometimes the very scary reality of living in a community that's not safe is too much to bear. We are committed to turning orphans and at-risk youth into children of promise. We fund a variety of programs to help those most in need as widely as we can. We invite and encourage you to join us today so that we can ensure their brighter tomorrow. Please visit genesis123.co to find out more and to send your love and most generous donation today.
Okay, excellent. Rolene, you haven't had a chance to chime in. Are we eradicating Hamas? Is it unrealistic? Do you want to disagree with Elliot and Chris?
I think what we see here is this is where you see military strategy and the information will kind of collide, because first of all, I think what people need to understand in the very fast-paced 24-hour news cycle is that we are a country at war. And while we expect to know everything, we don't need to know everything. We are a country at war fighting a military campaign with a lot of sensitivity around it. And also, I think the IDF is going to make public what they feel we need to know as public. And some of the statements today were very, very ambiguous. I mean, I as a journalist got a million messages from people on following certain WhatsApp groups saying, we're pulling out of Gaza, we've rolled over. No, first of all, read things properly. That'll be your first port of call. Second of all, always consider the source. And if it doesn't come directly from the IDF, the ISA, or the GPO, you know, maybe you don't want to consume that information. WhatsApp groups are not credible sources of information. third of all, you know, this is where we expect to know everything from the army. And I would caution people to remember this is a military campaign. We don't need to know everything. And with every military campaign, there is always that element of surprise that we need to respect. We are dealing with an enemy that is a lot more sophisticated than we realize, or than average people realize.
Surprise and diversion.
Exactly. This is an enemy that has spent now nearly two decades preparing for this war of war, prepared to sacrifice their civilian population, and with very, very heavy backing. And I don't just mean their Iranian paylords, but also the immense pressure being put on governments on the street, certainly from what we see. So my advice to people watching is always take that step back and consider before you consume any news or any information, consider the source and always look at the bigger picture.
Excellent. Thank you. I just have to say before we move on, I'm just so proud of myself because this is a great conversation. And I want to thank me for pulling the three of you together. This is great. Let's talk about the other strategy, the other goal of the campaign, which is to release the hostages, to free the hostages. There's a lot of public pressure now, but in November and December straddled one another, and we saw over a period of a week, 10 days, 105 hostages were released with a round of painful concessions and tremendous psychological warfare by Hamas. And since then, if I'm remembering correctly, I just put the notes together. Two were rescued, two men in a incredible military operation. Three, unfortunately, were killed by mistaken identity by Israeli troops. And the bodies of others have been found along with Israel over the period of months, declaring 30, 40 of the hostages dead based on incontrovertible evidence. Now, we've also been having on-again and off-again negotiations with Qatar and with Egypt and with the U.S. and Hamas, and we've been in Paris and Doha and Cairo, and I'm not even sure what else, and it doesn't seem like there's a whole lot of progress other than the fact that if we were having this conversation yesterday, it would have been 134 hostages. Today, it's 133 because the body of one man who was murdered was found. So my question, having set all that up, and in case I missed anything, feel free to ask, is the other goal of this campaign, of this war, to release the hostages, is it realistic? Is it something that is in direct conflict? There's a whole lot of pressure now. Is that domestic pressure here? Is that governing how we're carrying out the negotiations and or the military operations? Chris, since we can't see you, I want to ask you to chime in.
Well, I certainly think the goal remains the same as it has from the very beginning, to eradicate Hamas and get back the hostages. It seems tragically more unlikely that the hostages are going to see the light of day anytime soon. I think part of that is the United States initiative, or the abstaining from the United Nations Security Council resolution, I believe, on March 25th, not linking the hostage release to a ceasefire. In my sense, my understanding, that would embolden Hamas to keep the hostages as bargaining chips. So that's one, and I think Hamas really holds most of the cards because they hold most of the hostages that I know Islamic Jihad and others have some of them. And I would say that the pressure should always have been on Hamas and Qatar. And from a U.S. point of view, my understanding is that if the U.S. would have taken a lot more leverage than it has, because because CENTCOM is there in Qatar, and say, you know, maybe we could move this if you don't help us more. I think as a U.S. citizen, you know, there's eight American hostages, and I don't think there's been enough talked about them, I mean, from a U.S. point of view. So all that to say, it's going to be very hard for these hostages, and the stories of those that have been released is just horrific. And we just can pray that that somehow the remaining ones alive will stay alive and be able to be returned to their families.
Thank you, Chris. Elliot, we had a conversation early on, very early on, 5.5 months ago for a podcast. Maybe it was a webinar as well, talking about the what came up inevitably was a potential contradiction between the two goals. And I saw you motion when Chris was speaking about the hostages. What do you want to add to that?
I think it's a conflict on a level of order of priorities. In other words, they're not diametrically opposed, but as in any clash of values, sometimes you have to say, okay, this is a high priority, but that's a higher priority. So starting with the idea that, you know, bring them home, in my opinion, is the wrong perspective. Let them go is the perspective.
Right.
Yes.
We do want them back. It's a high value to bring them back. But at any price, what if Sinwar turns around and says, yeah, I'll release them all, dismantle your Zionist state and hand the whole thing over to Hamas, and whoever survives the experience will be allowed to remain. Do we do that in order to get the hostages back? I think not. Give us this or give us that. I think not. End the war, withdraw from Gaza, and let's all go back to October 6th. I think not. It's too high a national price to pay, with all the pain in that kind of a statement. Let's also keep in mind that the 100 hostages that were released in the original deal, and I hate to say it this way, but I'm measuring them from a Hamas perspective. The Hamas had too many hostages. They had more than they needed, way more than they needed. They had a surplus, if you will. Wow. I hate to use economic terms. And they were willing to trade them for a relatively low price, including a short-term ceasefire to allow them to regroup a bit, plus whatever they got in terms of personal trades of prisoners and that sort of thing. As the number is reduced, and we don't know what the real number is, but it's certainly not 130 live hostages, they become more and more valuable to Hamas, and they're less inclined to give them away under those circumstances, especially since they finally realized that if Israel's permitted to go to where it wants to go, Hamas is finished. Hamas has one objective here: end the war, get Israel out of Gaza. And I don't think they're gonna step down from that. Now we have to decide, do we give them a victory or don't we give them a victory? My opinion is we don't give them a victory.
Okay. Rolene? Again, there's
the issue
difference.
Of hostages for our viewers around the world is very, very personal to each and every one of us. We all know somebody that is either being held captive or know somebody that is being held captive. For me personally, several weeks ago, we received word that Daniel Peretz was murdered on the 7th of October, his body taken into Gaza. I know Daniel Peretz's parents very well from when I lived in South Africa and my aliyah here. I think the United States made a very, very dangerous mistake at the United Nations by not making any ceasefire contingent on the immediate and unconditional release of the hostages. I think we are seeing Israel becoming more and more of a political football amongst our allies as they try to placate elements of their high-voting constituents rather than have extreme moral clarity as far as hostages are concerned. We have a lot of accusations about the case at the ICJ, the International Court of Justice. Here I speak as somebody who grew up in South Africa and knows the South African paradigm very, very, very well and understands where the ANC's headspace is and the Israeli headspace. There is not enough pressure on countries around the world, including South Africa, to put the pressure on Hamas to release those hostages. You cannot make accusations of genocide in the media and wherever you want to make a political grandstanding without speaking about the immediate and unconditional release of the hostages. Every decision, every international decision should be met with the immediate and unconditional release of the hostages. And we as Israel need to make it very clear to the world, yes, we are a small country and we depend on our allies, but we are also not your political football. These are our citizens, our brothers and sisters being held captive in Gaza. We don't know how many of them are still alive. We know the unbearable conditions they are being held in. We know what has happened to our women. As a woman and as somebody who sits on the executive of a major women's organization, the wall of silence that we have faced is an absolute abomination, and we should hear more of an outcry there. But we can't just be a slogan, bring them home now. We need to see real action. And the real action, yes, does come with military pressure.
Excellent. Thank you. You didn't mean to set it up, Rolene, but as your three of you were speaking about it, I wanted to make a note to please underscore and ask everyone at some point to go to Genesis123.co and sign the petition, which, as Elliot noted, the call is not to bring them home, but to have them released, so they should be freed, and the pressure not on the government of Israel, but on the international bodies, including the United Nations, the Red Cross, all of the G7, and every country that had or has citizens who are hostages, which I think was somewhere in the range of 35 countries who had nationals who were taken hostage 6 months ago. I want to move the conversation forward. Again, this is one of these things that we can go on forever. Let's move to the north, to Elliot's neighborhood. For weeks now, almost on a daily basis, Hezbollah has been firing rockets and drones at Israel, inflicting damage, causing injuries and death, and resulting in some 100,000 Israelis who were displaced as domestic refugees from their homes. And it seems to me that Hezbollah is playing with us, just toying with Israel, waiting for Israel to respond, waiting for Israel to do something. And our response has been very, very limited, strategic, and maybe, Elliot, on a military basis, you can address that. Anyone who's been driving around Israel north of Tel Aviv along the coast recently has experienced the jamming of GPS, so their GPS-guided missiles will hopefully not hit where they're meant to hit. That doesn't mean they won't hit somewhere else. And my question is, as everyone asks me, is a war with Hezbollah inevitable? And if so, what is Israel waiting for? Elliot, I alluded to you. Go ahead. We'll talk about a military.
First of all, no war is inevitable, but this one is very, very, very highly likely. Anything can happen. Messiah can come tomorrow morning. So,
God willing.
God willing, but highly likely. We are doing damage to them, but not on a strategic level. I would say we are doing more damage at the moment to the Iranian resupply and upgrade operation in Syria than we are doing to Hezbollah proper. But here, the key is your question, what and when. So the what is, we must go into Lebanon at some point or another, and I'll say the when in a moment. We can't leave 100,000 Israelis out of their homes. By the way, many of their homes have been destroyed or heavily damaged, something that's not being reported. Much of the fire that's coming across the border into Israel is not appearing on the Red Alert app because it is either anti-tank guided missile, primarily the Cornet, which has an accurate range of 10 kilometers. In other words, they can be sitting 8 kilometers back in Lebanon and putting missiles through windows of homes all along the border, Metula, Kiryat Shmona, the kibbutzim and moshavim along the border, Shlomi. And they also have a low trajectory rocket that does not trigger the Iron Dome or the Red Alert app. So you only know that it's there when the first ones go off in a barrage. So much more is happening in terms of damage to our side than you're getting if you're just following the app. That's number one. Number two, the when, presuming they don't choose Western liberal democracy as an alternative in the next few weeks. There are two criteria. One is finishing up in Rafiah. Here, no secret. We could fight a war right now if we had to. We would prefer not to for a few reasons. One, we don't have the strategic wherewithal to do it well. This is part of the era, comes back to your first question. We used to have 4 Apache helicopter squadrons, and we eliminated 2 of them over the past decade because we didn't need them. Now the Apache squadrons are literally running on fumes. Pilots are exhausted. Helicopters are reaching the end of their maintenance schedules. They need to be grounded and redone. We've begged America for more. So far, they've said no. We don't have enough ammunition to fight a two-front war well. And I'm going to emphasize well. We could do it, but we're not going to choose to do it if we don't have to. So once again, the Rafiq operation is a prerequisite to going into the north on our terms. And last but not least, the weather. It's going to rain here tomorrow. We're predicting rain on and off through the week. You might think in 21st century warfare, what difference does it make? Mud slows everything down. The maneuver war in South Lebanon and into Lebanon will be very, very different from the Gaza one. It's going to be a classical type of maneuver divisions in open territory, tanks, armored personnel carriers, and they churn up the ground with their tracks. If the ground is wet, they will bog down. And I don't want to make predictions, but I'm looking at May, June.
May, June. Okay. Chris, what are you, I don't know if you've been reporting from the North at all, but what's your sense in terms of the inevitability and if you have any projections?
Well, I would say that we've been reporting or hearing almost verbatim what Elliot has been saying about the weather, about making sure the operation in Rafah is finished before you go to the north. You cannot live with 80 to 100,000 Israelis not in their homes or having their livelihoods. We have Julie Stahl, our colleague, has been up in Matula and saw many of the destroyed buildings there. I was up in Kiryat Shemona about 3 weeks ago. And also we had a colleague of ours, very rare. He was in South Lebanon. He was able to get in with the help of a friend and who has lived in that area at one time. And give a firsthand report from there. But I would say I've been hearing May, June, the same thing because of the weather, because of the operation in Rafia, and it feels kind of inevitable. And I think the lesson of October 7th is where the people on the Gaza border were able or lived alongside a monster for 17 years. And what I've been hearing of the people up in the north, they're not going to live with an even greater monster on the border up there in the north.
Well, the issue also, Chris, is that the greater monster to the north has missiles that can hit where you, Rolene, and I live. And with tremendous accuracy. So it's not just the residents of the north. Rolene, how do you feel about that?
I just want to take a step back, just back to the issue of the hostages. You mentioned the Red Cross, the United Nations. All of these organizations have failed their mandates in that they have done absolutely nothing to visit Israeli victims. I don't see any UNICEF people meeting with the Israeli families, Israeli children. We know it took UN Women nearly 3 months to acknowledge the atrocities committed against Israeli women, and the Red Cross have acted as taxi services, glorified taxi services, when it came to the release of our hostages, and even had the audacity, a violation of international law, to allow for Palestinian prisoners released to fly Hamas flags. So I think it's very, very important that we put the pressure on these international organizations. But back to the north, this is the war that nobody talks about. The situation in the north and the hundreds and thousands of Israeli civilians that are now internally displaced people or refugees, which is the other lexicon. The IDF released stats today. We have had over 3,000 rockets that not anti-tank missiles or mortars or any other projectiles, But over 3,000 rockets, we've just had several more a short while ago fired at our communities. And as you just said, Hezbollah are infinitely more sophisticated than Hamas. If Hamas is the Volkswagen Golf, then Hezbollah is the great big Cadillac or even great big truck of terror organization. They have precision guided missiles, an arsenal that effectively dwarfs that of Hamas. And they've got our entire country blanketed if they so desire. That is, it's a huge, huge concern. Is this a battle that we can preempt and solve diplomatically? We hope so. I know the Lebanese don't want this. There are already divisions in Lebanon between the Lebanese, the majority of whom are Maronite Christians and are vehemently opposed to Hezbollah. Lebanon is a country with a rapidly weakening what's left of their economy, and war brings more destruction and displacement to their people. How do we fight this? Do we fight this mostly from the air? Or will we have to go in on the ground and push back Hezbollah back north of the Litani River? They are in clear violation of United Nations Resolution 1701. Where is the international community putting that pressure to push them north?
Well, it's a failure of the international community allowing this to happen. I'll just opine as a non-military expert that talk about pushing Hezbollah back north of the Litani River sounds nice, but it doesn't really matter if we push their rockets and their personnel back 30, 40 more kilometers. So that means they hit maybe a little bit less further south in Israel, but that doesn't mean that we eliminate their infrastructure. I think we need to push them out of Lebanon. Yeah. And unfortunately, the Lebanese have not taken responsibility to do that yet themselves.
The restoration of Jewish sovereignty in the land of Israel was an earth-shattering event. For Christians, it was a confirmation that God always keeps his covenantal promises. Today, we are blessed to see God's fingerprints in the modern miracle of the land of Israel playing out in our lives among the people and in the state of Israel. This year, on the occasion of Israel's 75th anniversary, the Genesis 123 Foundation has been privileged to bring together 75 Christian leaders from around the world to lend their unique voices, sharing their personal faith experiences relating to Israel and their in-depth insight into Israel's history and spiritual significance, creating an historical, one-of-a-kind, high-end coffee table book, Israel the Miracle. Israel the Miracle's stunning imagery will fill your home with the hope of fulfilled promises and conversations about Israel. It's a perfect gift to anyone for any occasion, and most of all, to yourself. You'll also be a blessing to Israel, knowing that the proceeds will go to bless Israelis of all backgrounds. Be a part of Israel the Miracle and bring the land, the people, and the state of Israel into your heart and into your home. Visit israelthemiracle.com to get your limited edition copy today.
I want to move on, but Elliot, from a military perspective, Rolene just raised the question, is it an air? Is it a ground operation? You were talking about ground and tanks and artillery and people getting stuck in the mud. What's your sense?
As a ground forces officer, I love the idea of winning the war from the air. It means I get to sit home and drink coffee. It's been tried like in 2006. It doesn't work. It can't work. You can rain destruction down from the air, but you win the war on the ground. And the air is critical. Don't get me wrong. I'm not in any way denigrating the Air Force. They're a critical component in degrading Hezbollah's capability. They did it also in 2006. It's my estimate that Hezbollah has an arsenal of something in the neighborhood of 350,000 rockets, and they are taking into account that a significant number of them will be taken out by the Air Force in the first hours and days of a war. But ultimately, we're going to have to go in on the ground in a multi-divisional assault in order to clean out these areas, the villages, the area between the villages, And I agree with you. I don't think it can stop at the Litani. I think it has to go beyond the Litani and drive them back, and B, cause so much damage to them that even if they want to try doing it again, it'll put them back years, not by relying on UN resolutions, but by continuing, if they try to come back, continue what we've been doing over the past few years, and that is degrading them both in Syria and their resupply routes and Lebanon. And of course, the elephant in the room is Iran. I don't know if you want to go there at this point.
Well, so I was just going to go to Iran, and I wanted to use Rolene's analogy. We've got the Volkswagen in Gaza. We've got a Cadillac in Lebanon with Hezbollah, and Porsche came to mind. I don't know why, but we can go.
I was thinking more like the GM plant that's producing them.
Okay, there we go. Excellent. Right. So let's talk about that. Hezbollah, for anyone. A lot of the questions that we got and a lot of the interest that people expressed are for a genuine lack of knowledge because they're following international media and that's legitimate. So people want to know. So let's just cover one very important thing. Hamas in Gaza, Hezbollah in Lebanon, and the Houthis, who happened to fire some rockets and drones at Israel today again from Yemen, are all Iranian tentacles of the big Iranian.
Shiite militias in Syria and Iraq.
Right. And the Shiite, thank you. And Syria as well. Thank you. And Iraq, yes. And they've been hitting not only Israeli targets, but also American and other targets. And they have their eyes and are waiting to be able to swoop in and take over Jordan as well as anywhere else they can take. So the question is, if we push back, if we defeat Hamas, and we push back or push out Hezbollah in what will be a really bloody war, and we still have the Islamic regime as the plant that's producing these people, this ideology, A, will that work? And B, does Israel, is this the time that we need to go, whether they have an operating nuclear weapon or and the delivery capability or not, is this now the time that with or without other help, and I'd love to talk about who else might help, that Israel needs to go in and do business deep into Iran. Elliot, I'll let you pick up that conversation since you started it.
I don't think it's going to get better over time. I believe that we have the capability to do it. It would be nice to have help. 6 months ago, the Americans said yes, they would. Now, apparently, they're saying no, they won't. That was indicative in, for example, in the U.S. administration statement after taking out the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps Quds Force team in Damascus and their general, America immediately jumped in and said, hey, we didn't do it, don't hit us, which is sort of the diametric opposite of Biden's warning in October. You know, if you're thinking about joining them, don't, right? So guess what? Israel's on its own. This is hardly a newsflash. I think that one way or the other, we're going to have to deal with them, whether we prod them into starting it or whether we do it ourselves. As long as the Islamic Republic of Iran is there to operate, we will be threatened in one way or another. And let me just add, last but not least, you heard me say this before, Hamas is an Iranian proxy. The Houthis are an Iranian proxy. Hezbollah is not an Iranian proxy. Hezbollah is a wholly owned subsidiary.
He said that.
Of the
yes.
Force.
Correct.
And very, very different in that sense.
Okay.
They're an extension of Iran.
Chris, I heard you again audibly respond to Elliot's comment about Iran. What? It's one of the places in the Middle East I think you haven't been. What's your sense?
No, I haven't. I tried to go in there. A number of years ago, I was invited, and my boss said, no, I don't think you go because you might get in, but you may not get out. So, you know, the question about Iran is, we've been reporting on that, I think, almost 20 years. And the question is, will Israel do it? Can Israel do it? And who will help? And I would love the United States to be able to help. Unfortunately, we just reported that they helped waive sanctions that gave $10 billion to Iran, which in this climate seems just insane that you could be funding the enemy, your own enemy, as well as the enemy of your greatest ally in the region. You're right. Unless Iran is dealt with, Israel and the region will be under threat. And we haven't mentioned, Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Bahrain, that see Iran as as much of an enemy as Israel does. And also, while everybody is focused on Hamas and Hezbollah, Iran seems to continue its nuclear program. And very close to getting enriched uranium to military grade. And they certainly have the ballistic missiles. I guess one of the unknowns is how close they are to actually taking enriched uranium, putting it, miniaturizing it, being able to put it on a ballistic missile. I've heard estimates of up to a year, but I guess you don't know what you don't know. So that is the main question. Iran and the other, they're not sideshows by any means, but that is the main show, would be Iran.
Thanks, Chris. I want to pick up on that and then ask Raleen to comment. But before I do, ask I originally thought this would be a conversation of about an hour, but then I guess I was about as foolish as the people who didn't believe that Hamas would do what they did 6 months ago today. So with your graciousness, the three of you, I'd love for us to continue just for a few more general questions. But Chris, I was joking, of course, that you hadn't been to Iran, but as you mentioned it, and the other Arab countries, Saudi Arabia, the Emirates, Bahrain, perhaps less so Jordan, but you've been to a lot of these countries and you've had some really unique access in them, obviously without sharing anything that you can't, because a lot of that was off the record. Do you have any sense that if push comes to shove, any of these Arab countries will, if not go in with Israel in a military operation, at least facilitate it by refueling or overflights that aren't going to be harassed?
My sense is that they wouldn't necessarily, and Ellie can probably speak to this as well, necessarily join militarily, perhaps, have flyover rights, in particular in Saudi Arabia. When I was there in Bahrain, I would say specifically, but in the other two countries as well, one of a top official said the three main enemies of Bahrain is Iran, Iran, and Iran. And so they see it as a mortal threat, but they have to hedge their bets. If they see in particular that the U.S. is not the kind of regional or the superpower that it can be, they hedge their bets and they will waver a little bit. And you saw the UAE restore diplomatic relationships with Iran. They're just across the Persian Gulf from them, or the Arabian Gulf. So it's very difficult for these nations to know exactly which way the wind is blowing, particularly from the America.
Thank you. And the UAE also recently suspended diplomatic relations with Israel, or withdrew its... Go ahead, Raleen, correct me.
That's not true. That was put out by one of the networks here, and that was quickly debunked by the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, that's okay. Not true.
Good to know. Thank you. Raleen, as long as you're on, what's your sense of how we're going to respond to the vehicle production plant in Tehran?
Well, first of all, one thing that we have noticed, and we haven't spoken about it, we've alluded to it, is the Abraham Accords. And I think if there was ever a test of the Accords, now would be it. And they seem to be holding. They have legs and they are holding, I think, for a variety of reasons. I think because we are eventually all going to have to face down the big car production plant that we call Iran, that threatens all of us. I think also because we are dealing with a different kind of new Middle East when we talk about countries like Saudi, the UAE, Bahrain. These are countries whose leaders have recognized the value in Israel, recognize that we are not going anywhere, have very, very importantly started to change their curriculums in their schools, are very, very focused on tolerance and building a new Middle East that's an economic powerhouse, and understand that Iran keeps the region in medieval times with its ideology and with its propensity for warmongering and hegemony. So I'm very positive about our Abrahamic brothers and sisters, and I think our circle will get better. Some very encouraging words from an American official. I forget which one it was. I think it was either Sullivan or it was Ambassador Liu, I think it was. I could be wrong. Who said that the conversations around normalization with the Saudis is still looking positive. So I think we're dealing with more sophisticated neighborhood watch on that front. And I think while they want to quell the streets in their individual countries who are angered by the war that we have ongoing with Hamas. And I also want to stress to our viewers that, you know, we in Israel, contrary to what news outlets would have you believe, who infantilize us and tell us we are not aware of what's going on in Gaza, we are aware. Israelis are acutely aware of the suffering of the people of Gaza. It hurts us. It deeply, deeply saddens us and angers and frustrates us that Hamas forced upon us this war we did not want. But I think, and I have hope, that our Abrahamic partners, hopefully joined by the Saudis, will transform this region.
Excellent. Thank you, Roland.
Hey, Jonathan, I would add, too, we were in the Knesset last week, did a report on an update on the Abraham Accords and those that are working directly with it, you know, and you can measure this with trade and tourism. The Abraham Accord seems to be holding very well so far.
Friends, Israel's at war, and the war may get worse before it gets better, much worse. It's going to be a long war because the enemy is the epitome of evil. It's not just a matter of overcoming troops on a battlefield, but overcoming a theology, an ideology, an evil one. While the Genesis 123 Foundation has been overwhelmed with the support of so many donations to the Israel Emergency Campaign, there's so much more that needs to be done. We've invested your donations that we've received so far strategically to make the biggest impact possible, whether helping with soldiers and their equipment and personal needs, to providing civilian security for outlying border communities, to relocating and settling several families from near the Gaza war zone, launching the global petition drive to support Israel in the face of pressure for a ceasefire and long-term needs for at-risk children, traumatized now more than ever before. Please take a moment to pause this conversation right now and go to love.genesis123.co and donate generously. We value your trust, and we will keep all donors informed about how and where your donations are being used to contribute to make the biggest impact possible. And when you use that link, love.genesis123.co, you can also send your prayers and words of encouragement to Israelis of all backgrounds. Just sending your love, something that we need so desperately. Thank you, and God bless you and your loved ones.
Thank you. Taking that high note diplomatically, I'd like to bring us down to a low note, because it seems like as much as the consensus here is that we have perhaps shockingly or wonderfully good relations with our Arab partners in the Abraham Accords, that's less so, much less so around the world. At least what's coming out for public consumption. Elliot, you alluded to it earlier that in some cases it wasn't even a week, but a month, 2 months, and certainly some major unraveling of diplomatic support in recent weeks, specifically with the U.S., but around the world. I'm curious, and people are asking these questions. What do you see as the most problematic? Roline, you alluded to the International Court of Justice and the South African case against Israel for on charges of genocide. What's the most problematic? What are we doing right? Maybe we just answer the right part. What are we doing wrong that needs to be done differently? Because to me, at least, it feels like we're certainly fighting a front in Gaza. We're on the verge of fighting a front in Lebanon, Iran, Syria, the rest of the proxies coming from Iran are other possible fronts. But there's this tremendous diplomatic front that is taking a toll on us. Rolene, you started off about on the positive note, so I will bring you down to the ground with a realistic negative.
Well, I think, and as we speak, I've just received a news alert coming in from the United Kingdom that 3/4 of Muslims in the United Kingdom believe that 7/10 did not happen. There's this denial, which is, that sounds absolutely incomprehensible because we all watched it with our own eyes as the day unfolded in front of us. So I think that, especially for European countries like Britain with very, very big Muslim communities, there is this sense of needing to appease to I think some countries, the United Kingdom, Germany, France, know that they walk a very precarious domestic line and are trying to appease elements within their citizenry. And therefore, Israel is the political football, at least outwardly. We don't know what is being said behind closed doors. I do believe quite strongly, because I'm a masochist and I like to read the comments on YouTubes and articles, and the silent majority stand with Israel. The silent majority stand with Israel. I just wish they weren't so silent. I think a lot of people are very, very put off by the aggression, the intimidation, and the abuse tactics that they see from many in the pro-Palestinian camp. Then we get to South Africa, and that's a whole other paradigm. There maybe is another webinar to look at the issues at play. I think South Africa, we're dealing with issues of historical ties, electoral issues, economical issues, a variety of different issues at play. But I also want to stress, as a South African, that is the position of the ANC and their supporters in the country. It is not necessarily the position of the South African people. And we see this with the amount of solidarity groups. I know that it's the issue of the ICJ is very divisive. And why has that case been brought against Israel? Number one, to ensure that the term genocide is perpetually tied to the state of Israel, the crime of crimes, the people that were the victims of the worst genocide in history to be the perpetrators. Second of all, I think that a lot of money has made its way from the big car manufacturer to South Africa, who desperately need a win on the international stage and desperately need wins domestically. They cannot fix the water problem. They cannot fix the electricity problem. So maybe the social justice issue and the struggle credentials is an issue that they can deal with. South Africa's desperate to be a player on the international stage. And by bringing forward this case, they're certainly trying to establish that. What are we doing wrong diplomatically? Personally, and this is just me, I think we're dealing with a lot of institutionalized and systematic prejudice. I think we're dealing with a lot of that. But we also tend to forget that we have a lot of friends.
Okay.
We have a lot of friends around the world.
Excellent.
And just because we see a lot of posturing outwardly doesn't mean that we don't have those friends behind those closed doors, and that all the small countries that support us added together make a pretty significant block.
Excellent. Thank you, Chris. Let me go to you. I was going to do that anyway, But Rolene set it up in two ways. First of all, talking about our friends and a phrase that the prime minister has used often in terms of Israel having no better friends in the world than evangelical Christians. But when Rolene also mentioned all that watching all the negative comments on YouTube, you do a lot of media, and it's broadcast all over. And one of the things I admire about it is that there's always open comments. Are you seeing anything different from what Rolene said? Are there people trolling CBN? And what's your sense diplomatically, again, because you have had access to a lot of people that I don't think any of us have?
Well, unlike Rolene, I don't read the comments, so maybe I don't see exactly what everybody's saying. And I would add that I've seen such a wellspring of support from evangelical Christians. I can speak to CBN. I don't think Gordon Robertson has been extremely strong in his support publicly on an almost daily basis of Israel, following in the footsteps of his dad, Pat Robertson. I would say the diplomatic front is related directly, I believe, to the information war and the media war. And what I've seen over the years, and now it's just accelerated dramatically, is the strategy by Hamas to, it may initiate, like it did on October 7th, or maybe 2021 or 2014, and its strategy is to fire rockets and then use the media, and all of a sudden Hamas becomes the victim. And one thing it's done in this particular issues battle is, well, first of all, you rarely see a Hamas fighter. They're always embedded into civilians, not dressed as like they were on October 7th. And the number of dead in Gaza has been so inflated and taken by the media and politicians around the world as gospel. And I think that has fueled these terms of genocide and accusations against Israel. So all that to say, the information war, the media war, is so embedded into what happens diplomatically and politically throughout the world.
Thanks, Chris. Elliot, you want to chime in on the diplomatic stuff?
Sure. First of all, Raleigh mentioned this prejudice. Let's call it what it is, anti-Semitism.
Okay.
And it's out there. And Jonathan, you know, I'm co-authoring a book on the subject now. It's too short to go into any depth on it. But anti-Semitism is certainly a part of it. Second is a technique that's been used against Israel now for decades. I call it the epithet du jour. Whatever is the currency of condemnation in the world, we stick to Israel. Colonialism, imperialism, racism, apartheid, genocide, environmentalism, whatever it is, we're doing it wrong. You know, if you sling enough of it, some of it's going to stick. Goebbels and Hitler were right on the big lie theory. You tell a big enough lie enough times, it turns into the truth. And if you have social media and sound bites and sloppy, if not worse, mass media, and what I call the CNN phenomenon, not just the station, but the whole fast food, you know, news business, it just makes it that much worse. To your question, what we're doing wrong, I'll just a few words expansion on what I said earlier. We've always operated incorrectly on the idea that if you're right, you don't need to explain yourself. Back in the day, I don't know if you were living here at the time, there was a campaign about driving in Israel, driving on the roads. It didn't work very well, but it was an interesting campaign. When you're driving, don't be right, be smart. And I think we can apply that to our diplomacy as well, whether it's official diplomacy, semi-official, unofficial. Being right isn't good enough. You have to be clever. You have to know how to play the media game. They've forgotten or denied October 7th. Raleigh, absolutely. You read what's going on today. October 7th didn't happen, not just by the deniers in the active sense, But it's as if this war started capriciously by Israel, you know, a month ago or 2 months ago. The constant reminder, this is about October 7th. This is about Hamas. Let's go back further. This is about a Nazi ideology organization who, as is Hezbollah, as is Iran, whose stated goal is the annihilation of the Jewish people. That this isn't a cycle. There's a root to this, and I don't think you can repeat it enough. It's something that needs to be brought up constantly. This is what we're fighting, and we take it so much for granted that we simply forget to mention Roland.
Excellent.
And it turns into how many children were killed in Gaza yesterday.
Thanks, Elliot. There's a lot more that I would like to get into. Rolene, you opened the door for another conversation. I have another idea that with the three of you, I'd like to explore offline as a follow-up, because people really want to know. And first of all, someone is asking in the Q&A, where do we find out? And Chris, you should know that wherever I travel, when I'm speaking in churches or other interviews, I always tell them to CBN. And I shared with you recently how the very traditional Orthodox, elder Orthodox rabbi, who is the father of a good friend of mine, commented to me on Purim how the best news he gets is from CBN about Israel. So yeah, no, Rolene's nodding as well. So
excellent content. I also follow very closely.
Yeah. So kudos to you, Chris, personally, and your bureau, but of course Gordon and everything that CBN is doing. Yeah. And there are others, but we can go on in a lot of ways, and there's a lot of, unfortunately, unlimited questions just raised today that could take us another 3 or 4 hours. I'd like to wrap up with one. And one of the things I love about doing these, and I credit it mostly, not exclusively, but mostly comes from our Christian friends. The question generally, what can we do and how can we pray? And I'm looking at I copied it and I pasted to you all today, list of questions. What are our hopes? How can we help Israel? How can I help? I'm already praying. Are there any petitions I can sign? What are the strategic strategies for supporting Israel besides prayer and financial support? How can we best support Israel and her people right now? How can I encourage my pastors to support Israel and the Jewish people? How can we help Israel win the PR war? And it goes on. That's just about a third of the ones that I chose to share with the three of you earlier today. So I'd like to wrap up before we invite I'm going to bring on two friends who are going to formally close in prayer, but I'd like to ask the three of you, how do you respond? How can people, what's the best way to pray or help or support or be informed or any derivation thereof? And we'll end the same way we began. Rolene, ladies first.
First of all, I want to thank all of you out there for your prayers, because your prayers form a spiritual iron dome over all of us. We feel it here. And they are appreciated more than you could possibly know. So please, please continue to pray. And God bless all of you for always holding us in your hearts, in your thoughts, and in your prayers. As somebody working in the media and with information, the way that you can help us is to fight the propaganda and information war. Encourage your congregations, your friends, not to take what they see, especially on TikTok. TikTok is not a news source. What they see out there in social media or pushed through the mainstream media as the truth, but rather to investigate it for yourself. And we are always open to questions and welcome difficult questions. Chris, I can't thank you enough for CBN and your network for everything that you do to fight on that crucial, crucial battlefield, which is the propaganda and the media war. I think that's where we really, really need our foot soldiers out there as much as possible. I know the images that you see coming in from Gaza are deeply, deeply upsetting. They should be upsetting. This is what Hamas designed on the 7th of October. This is what they forced on all of us. None of us wanted this. None of us wanted this. But there is another side. And if you could bear witness and be our voices to the world and challenge the lies, challenge the misinformation, that will go a huge, huge, huge way to helping us turn the tide in the information war.
Thank you, Orlean. Elliot?
Ditto. I sign on to every word that Orlean said. I'll summarize it. Make Israel one of your priorities and stop being part of the silent majority. Become part of the noisy majority and get out there and let it be known what you're thinking, what you're feeling, because silence today is simply supporting the enemy.
The restoration of Jewish sovereignty in the land of Israel was an earth-shattering event. For Christians, it was a confirmation that God always keeps his covenantal promises. Today, we are blessed to see God's fingerprints in the modern miracle of the land of Israel playing out in our lives among the people and in the state of Israel. This year, on the occasion of Israel's 75th anniversary, the Genesis 123 Foundation has been privileged to bring together 75 Christian leaders from around the world to lend their unique voices, sharing their personal faith experiences relating to Israel and their in-depth insight into Israel's history and spiritual significance to create an historical, one-of-a-kind, high-end coffee table book, Israel the Miracle. Israel the Miracle's stunning imagery will fill your home with the hope of fulfilled promises and conversations about Israel. It's a perfect gift to anybody for any occasion, and most of all, to yourself. You'll also be a blessing to Israel, knowing that the proceeds will go to bless Israelis of all backgrounds. Be a part of Israel the Miracle and bring the land, the people, and the state of Israel into your heart and into your home. Visit IsraelTheMiracle.com to get your limited edition copy today.
Chris, we can't see you, but we feel your heart. How can you add to what Elliot and Rolene are saying?
Well, first of all, Rolene, I wanted to thank you for your kind, encouraging words. We do feel like we've been called for such a time as this to sort of stand in the gap, and we have an amazing team in our bureau and the support from CBN back in Virginia Beach and Gordon. And please do come to the bureau. You too, Elliot. I want to compliment you, Jonathan, too, President Company excluded. Just wonderful, wonderful conversation, I guess. In terms of praying, I would say one thing that we have done in some of our shows is pray the Psalms. And also, I discovered after the war began, you know, there's a prayer for the IDF, there's a prayer for the hostages, there's a prayer for the state of Israel. Those are wonderful prayers. And also, I what comes to mind is Isaiah chapter 62, that the Lord has set watchmen on the walls and give him no rest till he makes Jerusalem a praise in all the earth. I know a couple of weeks ago there was a global effort to pray the Shema, and also they've been down to the Kotel a couple of times when literally tens of thousands have gathered to pray and seek the Lord. Sometimes we may think, are these prayers being answered? But because things are very desperate, but yet without those prayers, maybe things would be much worse. And I think Psalm 83, I know, is a place where many people are praying as well. And so prayers wins the battle, and we've seen that in the Hebrew scriptures and Brit Hadashah as well. So all I could say, I guess, is to Rolene's point, get involved in the battle, get involved in the information war, and also the spiritual war as well.
Excellent. Thank you.
And I would add this, Jonathan. You know, I know some have seen it. What happened on October 7th, and if you had an opportunity to see that 47-minute unedited or raw footage, what happened on October 7th was demonic. It was you can't see that and see any explain it in any other way. So it's not just an information war, a diplomatic war, a military campaign. It is a spiritual battle as well. And I think Jews and Christians can rally together to wage this war.
Thank you, Chris. I'm glad none of this has been scripted, so I'm glad you ended up specifically on prayer and specific psalms and other scripture to focus us. That in of itself is worth rewinding and listening to, if nothing else here is. But I want to wrap up. Again, Rolene and Elliot and Chris, thank you so much for joining. We always end our webinars with prayer. That's a normal thing to do, whether we're seeking what to pray for or not. And today I've invited two additional friends to come and do that. And I see that she's unmuted at the moment. I'm going to call on Marzi Amirizadeh first. Chris, you know Marzi. And I just realized I invited her yesterday to join and realized that it was exactly a year ago this week that she came to Israel for the very first time and connected with us. And for those of you who don't know Marzi, I'll do a shameless plug for her and her website. Go to marzisjourney.com and you can read about her books and buy her books. But Marzi is an Iranian-born woman and a good friend who now lives in America and became a Christian in Iran and was sentenced to death and has a very special connection to Israel and the Jewish people. Marzi, would you like to begin to close us in prayer before I invite Pashali?
Yes, thank you so much, Jonathan, for inviting me to this great panel. It's such an honor to be in this panel, to listen to all the conversation and to pray for the state of Israel. As you mentioned, it was exactly the same dates that I was in Israel last year. I was so blessed to be in the Holy Land of Israel. But before I start praying, I just wanted to mention that that was a great conversation. And I agree with the panelists regarding Iran that as long as the Islamic Republic regime is in power, there's no end to this threat, to this war. And the Islamic Republic regime's intention is to distract us by, you know, getting involved, fighting with the proxies of the regime. But we all know that what is the true problem, which is the terrorist Islamic Republic regime that Iranians are suffering for more than 40 years. And nowadays they are standing with Israel and supporting Israel. And the big enemy of this regime right now are millions of Iranians who know the true nature of this regime. I'm not expert, military expert, but I always look at a Bible story. And I believe like the story of David, when he, King David, when he stood against Goliath and fought against him, there was two important points about that. That first of all, David knew the nature of this enemy. And he has already dealt with that enemy. That's why he was not an idiot to get involved in that battle. And the reason he got involved, because he knew the nature of this enemy. And second, he knew where to target, where to hit. He didn't hit other parts of the body of Goliath, the biggest enemy, but he targeted the head of the Goliath. And that's why he was able to defeat that big enemy. Thank you so much. And I know I should not talk more, and I'm going to pray. As I mentioned, it's such an honor to pray for the Holy Land. Dear Father, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, I come to your presence in unity with my brothers and sisters, Jews and Christians, to pray for the Holy Land of Israel, to pray for the chosen people who are fighting against the most dangerous enemy right now, to ask you and to pray for wisdom, for guidance, and for victory for the state of Israel. Father, I pray for the country, your beautiful country, for its protection against all the attacks from the enemies, from the Islamic Republic regime, from protected from their missiles, and be the true shield for your country, for the Holy Land. Father, I pray for the people of Israel, they have experienced the massacre of Hamas attack on October 7th. And you know that this war isn't started only on October 7th. It started way beyond before that. I pray for the unity of Israeli people, Jewish people at this critical time. I pray for their courage, for their faith, and not to lose hope and to understand that you are behind them and you're fighting for them and they are not alone in this battle. Please remind them that you are Jehovah, the God of Israel. Father, I pray for the hostages, for widows, for orphans. Please protect them. Give them courage and boldness. Let them not to lose their hope and trust you that you are with them in their captivity. Please hold them in your arms. Please set them free and bring them back to their family members. Please give patience to their family members and strengthen them. Father, I pray for the IDF soldiers, for every soldier that is fighting on the ground, to give them courage, to give them boldness, to be fearless, to give them the power of 10 soldiers, to protect them with the invisible angels. Let them know that your hand is behind them. Remind them how Joshua fought against the enemy of Israel, how you opened the river for them, how you stopped the sun and the moon when all kings started fighting against Joshua's military. You told them that don't have any fear because I am behind you. I am fighting for you. Father, I pray for the leaders of Israel that to consult with you, to inquire with you before making any decision, to know that you are above everything, that you are in control. Give them your heavenly wisdom. I pray for the Western leaders to come and to stand with Israel in this battle, and the Biden administration to stop appeasing terrorists and giving them funds. Father, I pray for the Palestinians that you give them courage to stand against Hamas terrorists, their eyes to see their true enemy, like Iranians for many years didn't know who is their true enemy. And now they can see and they are standing with Israel. Father, I pray for the enemies of Israel. I pray that you change their hearts to repent, melt their hearts in fear. Let them to see that you are behind your country and your people. Make them confused and defeat them completely. And the head of this enemy, which is the Islamic Republic regime, Father, I pray to destroy them completely. I remember when I was in prison suffering, you told me that you will give a chance even to the most cruel people. But if they do not repent, you will destroy them all. That's your promise, Father. And I ask you to bring your justice and destroy this cruel enemy. Destroy their witchcrafts and their evil plans against Israel. Let no one dare say any words against your chosen people. Father, I pray for Israelis and Iranians' friendship to restore this friendship after the fall of these cruel leaders of Iran, to bring true leaders who respect Israel, who restore this friendship, truly stand with Israel. And at the end, Father, I pray for the churches, for Christians all around the world to understand the importance of standing with the state of Israel. Please wake up the churches. This is a wake-up call for all Christians all around the world. Let them to stand with their Jewish brothers and sisters, and let them to stand with them, to support them, that they are not alone. let them to understand that this is not just a war in Israel. This is a war against evil. This is a war against darkness. This is a war against a dangerous ideology. Please, Father, wake up your churches and your children, that not to repeat the same mistake many years ago, and to stand with this state of Israel. And I pray for each panelist today, everyone, Jonathan, who is started this panelist, to bless him for his work, for supporting his people, and for his children who are in this war. In the name of my Savior Jesus, in the name of the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, I pray. Amen.
Thank you, Marzi. I want to, it's a tough act to follow, but I want to invite another good friend, Pauschali Las, in Germany. She and her husband hosted me 2 weeks before the war broke out, as what was supposed to be the beginning of our book launch tour that was delayed. Pauschali, welcome.
Yeah, thank you very much. Thank you to the panelists also from my side for a very, very insightful discussion. I'll go straight to prayer. Dear God, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the Almighty God, you are sovereign, and there is nothing impossible for you, and you know everything, Lord, and you see everything. You see the injustice, you see the lies, you know everything, and you are the great judge, and we depend on you. Israel may be feeling very alone at the moment, but Israel always will have the God of Israel. So I pray, God, that you bring out your mighty hand to save Israel from the enemies. Give your wisdom to the leaders to fight the military war as well as the PR war, which is really, very deceptive, Lord. I pray that you give immense wisdom to each of us involved, Lord, in our own world. Help us to become ambassadors for Israel, for the truth. And God, I just want us to remind ourselves that you said that there will be a time of Jacob's trouble and distress, but Jacob will be delivered. So we know, God, that Israel will be delivered by you. Please do it soon, God. And thank you for everything. Thank you for your Iron Dome of protection. And I pray that you continue to protect the people of Israel and bring back the hostages, God. Amen.
Thank you. All a tough act to follow. The comments, apologies to everybody whose questions we didn't get to. The comments, the effusive remarks to you, the panelists, Rolene, Elliot, and Chris, thank you for joining for this tremendously insightful and for staying much longer than I think anyone had planned. I'd like to ask everybody just a couple of quick follow-up points. First of all, again, as I said at the outset, everything you need to know about the Genesis 1-2-3 Foundation, you can find or communicate through our website, genesis123.co. If you're looking for a place to give money, to make a financial contribution, we're doing things with the highest integrity and the greatest impact possible. Please consider supporting what we're doing. Please make a note again of the Global Day of Prayer for Israel on May 15th. More information will be coming about that very shortly. Please go to the Genesis 123 Foundation website to sign the petition and share that link as widely as possible, because we need an army. We need hundreds of thousands or millions of people to push back on the pressure that Israel's getting diplomatically and do everything we can to get the hostages released. And finally, wherever you follow this or see it, whether it's a podcast or whether it's on YouTube, please share this. It's an unbelievable conversation, super important, one that will have significance, of course, in the coming weeks, months, and beyond. I want to thank everybody and pray that wherever you are, that you and your loved ones are all safe and healthy. God bless you.